This is K. Scott Allen of odecode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Kuhn from lazycoder.com.
Hello and welcome to Herding Code. This episode is being recorded on July 1st, 2010, and tonight we are talking to friend of the show, Jeff Atwood. I think, how many times have you been on? It's been a few.
I think just once. Oh. Before. All I remember is there was a Glockenspiel.
Okay.
There was a Glockenspiel reference, and that's what I remember. That's actually all I remember. I don't know if that's good or bad.
Yeah, I don't know how we can top that either.
That's good.
That pretty much covers it, I think.
All right. Well, so let me see. I guess we can just jump right in. You had said you were interested in talking about Area 51, and so can you explain what that is?
Yes. So all this really relates to Stack Overflow and the things that came out of Stack Overflow. And I'm not going to go into the sort of the ancient history of Stack Overflow, but Stack Overflow has been, by most metrics, very, very successful, both in terms of meeting our goals of just, you know, getting better information on the internet for programmers, and in the other goals of just, you know, displacing some of the other things that were out there that people hated, like Experts Exchange, aka the hyphenated site, which sort of had some weird and scammy ways of doing things. And along the way, we learned a whole bunch of stuff, you know, not just programming stuff, but like how communities work, and, you know, not that these are any great secrets, but there's certain the software does sort of control in some ways how people behave, which is really fascinating. And the Q&A format in particular, I think, is really a useful one and was sort of underutilized on the net. Like when we started looking at Stack Overflow, we did all this research about, you know, what Q&A engines are out there, because I had never really even thought about it, honestly. I couldn't remember the last time I, you know, other than accidentally ending up on Yahoo Answers, which is always hilarious. I never really thought about it, really. But once I started investigating, there's tons of these Q&A sites out there. There's really a lot, and a lot of them do a lot of traffic. Like I think Answers.com is like a top 100 website, and they're a Q&A engine. So the format itself has a lot of strengths. And certainly Joel and I knew the programmer audience and sort of had an idea of how things work and the type of things we like to see and the type of things programmers like to see. And then sort of combining a lot of sort of the greatest hits and creating this sort of Frankenstein monster of all the ideas that we thought worked from the sites that we liked. And all that is basically Stack Overflow. So when you go to Stack Overflow, that's what you're getting in a nutshell. And so that's working. And as we had Stack Overflow, we realized that, gosh, there's a lot of questions that aren't programming questions. But we have a lot of really smart people on Stack Overflow, programmers with a lot of varied interests. And these questions come up that aren't really programming questions, but they're still really kind of interesting for geeks. And so that's when we branched out into Server Fault, which is for system administrators. And we took sort of that baby step of, okay, there's programmers who are also system administrators. And then to Super User, which is just general computer software and hardware questions. And that's sort of the farthest afield from programming, because that's just, you know, why is my scanner not working? why can't I get Photoshop to load? Or, you know, really anything dealing with computer software or hardware. And one of the things we saw there was that the topic was inherently very broad. And this to us is a risk, because what brings a community together is that they have things that they love and things that they, I say hate, but Joel gets scared when I say that, things that they don't love, that they actively sort of campaign against to the extent that they may or may not hate them. And that's actually what brings a community together. You hang out in the same place because you have people that sort of plus or minus 10% love the same things you love, at least some subset of the things that you love, not everything, obviously, and then kind of hate the things that you hate too, you know, and you have those things in common, and that's sort of what holds you together, and that's why you like hanging out there, because you have those sort of shared values. And we put the focus on the information. Like, we're producing information and we're learning from each other, and there's this really strong learning vector of getting better at doing X, where X is some basically semi-professional kind of thing. And you can already see with Super User, we're getting out of kind of the realm of professionalism to some degree, because these are just generic computer questions. I mean, you have sort of IT staff, and, you know, but the idea, these are just enthusiasts, right? They're not necessarily paid to do this stuff like programmers and sysadmins tend to be. So already we're deviating from the engine a little bit, and just mapping the surface of the topic became very hard. We had to almost immediately disallow questions about websites, which is kind of wrong if you think about it, because software in the long run is websites. I think client software is pretty much going to be dead soon. I mean, the iPad and iPhone and all this stuff. But immediately we had to say, okay, when we say software, we're not talking about websites. And this is a huge schism in the community, because they're like, how can you do this? This is wrong. You know, when I use my computer, I think I go to Google, I get my Gmail. To me, that's a software application. And we just arbitrarily had to disallow it because the topic was already so broad. And I think it's challenges like that that brought us to, you know, how do you figure this stuff out before you launch the site? Like, what is the topic and what are the dimensions of the topic and what does the community love and what do they hate? And, you know, how can we bring the people together and make that happen? So that was sort of challenge number one, was sort of getting outside of what I call the geek ghetto. It's like, can we even get outside the geek ghetto? I mean, I don't think Reddit really has. Dig, I guess, to some degree has. I think that's the biggest challenge. I mean, if you look at our big, hairy, audacious goals, because we're now a venture capital funded company, and we have 20 plus employees now. It's crazy. We're have as many employees as Twitter at some point, which just blows my mind, because it was always shocking. It's like Twitter has 30 people and has had 30 people for a long time. I'm like, what do they do? You know, because Twitter, for the last 3 years, was anything improving? Was anything actually even better? It's like, what do they do all day?
Well, they rewrite things in different languages.
People. It's crazy.
Yeah. You have twice as many people as the ASP.NET team now then.
Yeah, we have tons and tons of people. And it's exciting because now we can, when we were really small, it was just, you know, me and Jared and Jeff and Joel. And Joel was really just advising us, right? He wasn't checking in code or anything. We had to really pick what we could do. We had to say, okay, this is the thing that we can do. Of all the things we would love to do, we can only do this one thing because we'd rather do one thing really well and just, you know, do a bunch of stuff poorly and spread ourselves extremely thin just seemed like a really bad option. So we had to, a lot of stuff we would love to do, had to put on the back burner and say we couldn't do. And now we can do all that stuff, which is, it's amazing because we have really talented people and we're attacking all the important problems that we want to solve, which is just exciting. So it's more like juggling now. but I feel like we're making real progress. I don't feel like we have to abandon things because we don't have enough, you know, sort of manpower to get things done. So it's exciting. But going back to Twitter, the reason I brought up Twitter is Twitter is completely mainstream now. I mean, and the average person has heard of Twitter. That's sort of the end state. If you can build software that people have heard of, an average person, I'm not talking about your geeks or stuff, that's amazing. I mean, that's sort of where we would like to eventually get, but it is the big, hairy, audacious goal. It's going to be very, very hard to get there. But anyway, just to put some scope around it and give you some idea of our goals and stuff. And so Area 51 is our way of democratizing the process of creating these sites. So when you have an idea for a site on a topic, you would actually go to Area 51 and propose it. It's very much like the political process. You know, you have a bill. You know, I'm just a bill. I'm sitting on Capitol Hill. And then other people, generally sort of harvested from the community or network of existing sites, will go to Area 51 and see this proposal and say, oh, I think that's a good idea, or I think that's a bad idea. And we funnel people through this idea of, rather than just randomly talking about, is this site a good idea or a bad idea, give us some questions that you would ask on the site. Like, what would you ask? Like, if you went to the site, what would your questions be on the site? Because that keeps it focused to what's actually going to happen on the site, which is that people are going to go and ask questions. And we want to determine good questions and good and bad is not the right word, on topic and off topic questions, because this is how you map the dimensions of a topic and thus the community is what do they like? What do they like to talk about? And what do they sort of view as the common enemy that they're sort of acting against? And if you can figure that out, then you can proceed to the next step of the process, which is people committing to say, okay, if this site existed, I would actually go there, you know, 3 times a week and actually ask questions and, you know, sort of help the site come into being. It's like this whole process. So you have proposal where you define the questions, then you commit to the site and say, hey, and then if enough people commit, and this is where we factor in network reputation, we have this fancy reputation system, the more high rep people commit, the more likely the site is to get created. So if you have 10,000 newbies, you're going to have a problem because they don't really understand how the Q&A format works. There's a certain amount of education that goes on with our engine because I think people are used to very primitive, the PHPBB, sort of what I call the Soviet era software that's out there. these concrete blocks of just post, 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 post. You know, it's just a simple chronological thing where nobody ever reads anything but page 50 because there's 50 freaking pages and everybody has their stupid little signature blocks and the information is just buried. That's what they're used to and that's what they expect, and they sort of get a little PO'd when it doesn't work exactly that way. Actually, it's they've become so used to it and so indoctrinated in it that's all they understand anymore, which is kind of unfortunate. So we want some users with reputation in our system who are experienced users to teach these other users. You need a certain balance of experienced users. They're saying, okay, look, this is how the Q&A format works, rather than posting a bunch of stuff that isn't answers. Just edit your question to refine it, to add more detail as you learn more about the problem problem or whatever it is you're trying to figure out, just edit your question and refine it, and we'll do the same with our answers. And that's really the main stumbling block, is getting out of the idea of every time I do something, I create a new post. You're supposed to go back and sort of edit stuff fairly aggressively. Not all the time, but in general, that's the main stumbling block. So you want some mixture of those users and then synchronizing them. So if you get enough people committing, we have a private beta, which we have a private beta going on for web applications. That's the first one to go through. And all these people get emailed that committed, and they all sort of come together at once. That was the other thing that seemed to matter, was getting sort of the right people at the right time. So you don't end up with, hey, I'm launching this site, it's completely blank, and then one person wanders by and he's like, oh, this is a blank site, boring. And then, you know, another person wanders by, blank site. I mean, you never really, it's like a party, right? You have a party, there's like one guy hanging out dancing by himself. Right. Nobody's going to go to that party.
That's,
you have to have the appearance of, like, you know, some hot chicks and, like, right, some salsa, and some stuff has to be going on in this party for people to come in at all. And this kind of solves that, because you have people that want it to exist, and they all have this private VIP entrance period, this private beta where only they can come in and seed the site. And then, you know, then you've solved the problem. You don't have a ghost town. You have actually what looks like a very vibrant site when you go to public beta.
I remember Joel talking about that a little bit in the original Stack Overflow, of, you know, some of the problems of coordinating the alpha periods. And if you get people to alpha or beta test too early, they go, they check it out, and then they leave. And they're done. So, you know, whereas, like you're saying, you need a critical mass when the site actually launches. So that sounds, I mean, like, you know, that's been refined through that process too.
And to Joel's credit, this is really, Joel is the PM. And you know, when we say PM, I can never remember, is it program manager or product manager? Because one is bad and one is good, and I can't never remember which is which. But whichever one of the good one of those is, that's what Joel is for Area 51. Joel had this, the impetus of this idea, which was, let's take all the stuff we're doing when we launched Server Fault and Super User. We did all the stuff, sort of, we just knew the right things to do. But let's create a little bit of a process, this democratic process that everybody can participate in, and sort of guide them through this process. And so they'll be poised to succeed rather than fail. Because with the old system, which was, okay, give us $129 a month and do whatever. I mean, what was really our incentive to care if these sites succeeded? I mean, we get their money either way, right? And plus money. I mean, money is just a bad motivator for anything social online, in my experience. There was just no real, the incentives were not aligned really at all for success. I hate to say this, but I didn't really care if those sites succeeded, because I wasn't invested in them the way I'm invested in these new sites that are coming up. You know, I feel like we created these collectively together. We're building up this knowledge base that's going to actually benefit, you know, anybody that comes along. And it's sort of, you know, you have your little small piece of that, and you're sort of proud of the time that you've invested in that, you get back. And you sort of made the web better. That's the thing that we decided was sort of, I mean, Joel phrases it as, you know, in terms of Q&A, you know, make the internet a better place to get answers to your expert answers to your questions. But to me, it's very simple. It's just, is this making the internet better? Yes or no? And to me, it's exciting to sort of, it's like gardening. You're building a garden on your little piece of the web, and you're saying, hey, I'm going to grow some fruits and vegetables. And, you know, these are useful things that I'm creating that people can, you know, get sustenance from. And it just feels good. It's like you're growing things and you're building things that kind of matter in the global sense of the word.
So you're giving people more of a sense of ownership and I don't know, community, rather than just kind of like, I remember the same kind of thing. It's these, you know, like when Stack Overflow was launching, it felt like, hey, this is like our community is doing this thing almost, you know, whereas like when you'd hear about other Stack Exchange sites launching, you're like, oh, that's neat, you know, but you didn't have that whole kind of community feel, like you're saying, and the kind of community ownership too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's really what makes it fun for me, is that, you know, everybody, it's really to show off what you know as a user of the site, and, you know, for you to learn from other users. That's really the point of the engine. And when we start getting a far afield from that learning type motivation, like there's a proposal for a gaming site which is doing very, very well, which I'm a little nervous about, because to me, I'm a gamer. I love video games, don't get me wrong, but it's not really a great learning topic. I don't feel like it really drives anything that's a huge useful amount of time to spend on stuff. So that I think is something we're going to struggle with. But as the process goes on, we'll hopefully figure that stuff out.
So Jeff, to what extent do you feel like the fact that you're drawing from your existing user base sort of perturbs the topics that are being suggested and or voted for. I mean, because you're sort of front-loading your user base with a bunch of geeks, basically.
Geeks, I think everybody has a lot of varied interests. I mean, this is the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon thing, where you start with somebody who is a programmer and a sysadmin. Okay, that's not a huge step, right? But then it's a sysadmin who loves, you know, cooking. And one of the big surprises for me was that the cooking proposal is basically kicking ass. It's I think, third or fourth. If you go to the homepage of Area 51 and sort by progress, it's in the top five. That really shocked me. And then eventually you're going to get to somebody who is an avid cook, is going to find that site. And he's a cook and, you know, an amateur pilot, airplanes. So maybe he'll get involved with that community. I mean, the hope is that you'll eventually take enough steps where you'll end up outside the geek ghetto. I don't know if that's actually what's going to happen, but that's my hope.
So with specific topics like that, like cooking, let's say, for example, there are several very famous chefs and authors who are, you know, pretty active on the net. Have you thought about reaching out to what's maybe celebrity is a bad word, but well-known, like experts in some of these topic areas that are being promoted or that get launched to kind of soak it? Because if, you know, an Alton Brown shows up on your cooking site and starts posting or answering questions, everyone's going to be there. You know, everyone who knows about Alton Brown and wants to learn about cooking is going to be on that site and posting questions and replying and whatnot. And the same, or if you get Anthony Bourdain, same as if you get, you know, John Skeet or Donald Knuth or anyone like that on Stack Overflow answering programming questions. I don't know if you'd thought about, you know, when a topic does come up, trying to reach out to, you know, celebrities or well-known experts to get them to participate.
I think there's really two answers to that. One is that as sites are launched and they sort of become, they survive, because it is possible for us to have a site that makes it to a certain point and then just doesn't quite push through. We have metrics that we're still establishing some of these numbers, but you must reach certain metrics for the site to even survive, to get out of private beta, to get out of public beta. And then presumably once the site is live, hopefully it won't have those kind of problems. But in theory, we could kill sites. We've said from the get-go that we're not shy about, if something isn't working, we're going to kill it. Now, we will make the data available, because everything we do is under Creative Commons. We're not going to destroy anything, but we don't want to put up ghost towns ultimately that aren't working, because we don't feel like that makes the internet better. It's just sort of like driving through the abandoned area of town where the windows are all boarded up, and it's just not really a good feeling, right? It's like, oh, there's stuff there. This was alive in, you know, 1980, but it's not doing so hot now. So we will kill things that aren't working. But if something is working, we're going to actually have a budget, and we're going to work with the community itself and say, hey, we have a budget. What are some good ways to promote this community on the internet? Not stupid stuff by buying AdSense, which doesn't even really work in my experience, but like, who are the experts? What are the conferences that you guys go to? You know, who can we approach to see if they like what we're doing and they get that, you know, we're actually trying to build a valuable repository of information? And they're welcome to participate and bring their community and all that stuff. So I think there's going to be a budget that we target, and the community is hopefully going to tell us, like, you know, what makes sense for us to spend this money on for you guys to build your community. But so the second part of that is, we found that people who have entrenched audiences and already sort of have their own thing going aren't really too keen on giving up control of that stuff. And we've said from day one that the community is in control. Like, and this is Creative Commons information. No one really owns it. I mean, nobody goes to Stack Overflow and says, this is Jeff Atwood's site. I mean, I hope they don't. Or Joel Spolsky's site. I mean, the site really is for the programmers that participate there. It's not my site. I curate it and I help do the gardening. And I treat it like a public park that I help maintain because I'm proud of the park. You know, it's a public resource for everybody to benefit from. Now, granted, we're still a commercial company, blah, 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 but that is personally how I view it. And you would have to bring on somebody like Anthony Bourdain, who's not going to be like, okay, this is all about my book, and I have my site, and it has to be branded, you know, with my stuff. And in our experience, that tends to happen. Like, people have their own little fiefdoms, and they're not really willing to give control to the community in that way. But if somebody is, we will certainly be really happy to work with them. But I just want to mention that caveat.
Cool. Okay, Scott, just a pulse check.
I am still alive, yes.
Oh, good. Any reactions so far?
Not yet. I'm waiting for the good stuff.
Poised to strike like a viper. Okay.
all the secrets that we have. Did you want to cover any Twitter? I apologize. I mean, Area 51 to us is, to me, it is very exciting. I mean, I really want to see what the engine can do, and I want to reach out to these communities. And I've said before that I really hate a lot of the software that's out there. I genuinely feel like there is a better mousetrap for getting information on the internet.
Yeah.
And I think in some ways we can be a part of that. And to me, that's really exciting. I mean, I don't know how successful it will or won't be, but I'm trying to follow a playbook that I think is very fair and tries to weight heavily what the community itself wants.
I think this is really interesting. I mean, it's definitely kind of like, of course, like the way that you run Stack Overflow and the stack, you know, the whole whatever Stack Overflow family is interesting because it's all very public and you talk about what works and what doesn't. And I have to say, I had the same kind of misgivings about, you know, the whole Stack Exchange thing was like, you know, you pay a subscription. I just didn't see the whole kind of magic of what made Stack Overflow really exciting working there, you know, and that it's more than just the cool software. It's how it's set up. It's the whole community. It's all that stuff. And so I think it's just been interesting to watch this whole process as you've evolved it. And, you know, I'm happy to see it moving in that way. So
I agree. There was something to me that was wrong about the other strategy. And I didn't really want to say it in public because, number one, you know, my business partner, Joel, they sell software. There's nothing wrong with selling software. But I think I've really just stopped believing in selling software at some fundamental level. I just do not believe in it anymore. And that's kind of painful to sort of admit in public.
Well, or the models have changed, right? I mean, you still buy software, but you buy it for your iPhone, or you buy it for, you know what I mean? You buy different, the things that'll get you to buy software and the ways you'll buy it are different.
It's just bizarre because, I mean, I posted on my blog about Daniel Pink and, you know, the Wikipedia and the Apache and the Linux examples that they use. It just seems like we're building stuff that it's a very non-traditional job anymore. You know, it's very heavily motivated by, you know, getting up in the morning and wanting to do things that you actually enjoy versus the things that you get paid to do. And that's just a tricky, you know, thing to navigate, I think.
I think some of this, I mean, I almost go back to the, like, the whole Clay Shirky thing and the whole, like, I forget, it was probably him. I read an article a long, long time ago in Wired about just the surplus that we have, surplus of time and of, you know, just everything. And so how that changes markets, like how people used to have to work all day to feed themselves. And now in 10 minutes, you can get enough to subsist on, you know, in a minimum wage job. And so, and all those things. And that's why Wikipedia works and how that applies specifically in the computer industry, you know, where it's like things that were just not viable and where the only model that really worked was you would buy a software license. And now it's like, it just, things have changed so much with the freely available internet and the rapid development and just everything has just gotten so cheap that the models have to change.
And at some level, it feels a little dirty, too, because I feel like we have these dream jobs and, you know, there's still a lot of really poor people. And there's a lot of people that work very, very hard at jobs they don't necessarily like. Mm-hmm. So I think I struggle with it internally as well. to me, it's just kind of magical. I mean, even with Coding Horror, it was kind of magical. It's like, okay, I write this blog. And granted, I haven't been running as much lately, point noted, but, and then just all this thing, all these things just magically start happening to me. I mean, it was crazy, right? I mean, the world literally just sort of beat a path to my door and gave me all these opportunities and it's just, the model has been so flipped on its head. It's just bizarre. I mean, it's almost like waking up and, you know, being in this magical dream wonderland.
There was that part where you sold your soul to the devil. I mean, you haven't mentioned that part, but that does come in. I mean, some of that.
Yep.
That was a bad joke. Sorry. Should we? another question I had, if you want to move on, I was thinking of talking about the API changes and both the Stack Overflow API and then also the Stack Exchange. I forget the official product name for it, but the thing I saw this.
Yeah. So the API, if anyone's interested in the Stack Overflow API, which is still technically in beta, but it's very, very close to being released. And we actually have a really sweet contest, may I promote? we're actually, if you build an app with our API, and the reason we're doing this is not because we want to pay people to build stuff with the API, but we want to make sure during this beta that people are actually building, like, you know, real functional apps that, like, get deployed and used so that we know that the API V1 is, like, solid. That's really the motivation. But the prizes are quite cool. We're doing 30-inch monitor. an Aeron chair, a netbook, and also an adjustable height desk. So if you're interested in any of that stuff, there's still time. Go to stackapps.com and check out the API. That's the site that sort of documents the API, and you can ask questions. And it's also got like a little app gallery on the app tab. You can see what people are building.
And then, I mean, technically, the API is all, it's all very like RESTful and JSON, right?
Let me illustrate sort of the way I approach building the company by talking about the API. So what happened was we didn't have time. We knew API was going to be A, hard, and B, we wanted the site to the core of the site to be stable before we even got to the API, because, I mean, you can't build an API on shifting sands. but we finally got close enough, and there was this one student at Rice University, this guy, Kevin Montrose, who had just like jury-rigged this API based on like HTTP requests, and like he had sort of reverse engineered a bunch of stuff we did on the website and had kind of synthesized this API for us. I was like, wow, that's very cool. So I wrote a blog entry about it. And then I noticed like on his Stack Overflow profile, it's like, hey, I'm looking for a job. And I was like, this is like exactly what the dream position falling into my lap. It's like the ideal candidate. Here, we need an API. Here's a guy who has built an API from scratch. He's obviously extremely talented. He's a Stack Overflow user. And then I felt like an idiot for not like realizing this like, you know, a month earlier. So we ended up hiring Kevin, and Kevin has worked on a variety of things, but for the last couple months, he's been working full-time on the API to make sure that it's of sufficient quality, because everything we've read about APIs indicates that, that V1 of the API, you want to be extremely careful because you get locked in to the decisions that you make about this API are like permanent and very hard to change down the line. So it's better to be extremely conservative, gather tons of feedback, which is the point of the contest, and sort of rectify any major issues, the ones that you can, before shipping. So that's sort of been our strategy, is go very, very slow and have somebody very, very talented, dedicated to it, working on it. We have a site dedicated to it to make it as good as we can be. Because to me, API was very risky. Like, I was very nervous about it. I don't know. I mean, what is you guys' attitude towards API in terms of, like, how important is it for a site to have an API? I mean, when do you get angry when a site doesn't have an API? What does the API really do for a website? If the website is really functional, which I think Stack Overflow is, let me play devil's advocate here. It's like, why should we have an API? What's the point?
Mostly it's for personal branding. So I want to be able to, and it, you know, and you guys provide that already through badges and stuff, but maybe there's some other things that we want to be able to do. The things that get me wanting an API and a website, and as grammatically horrible as that sentence is, if I can't get my data out any other way via an export button or something like that, if I want the site to interop with another site that I have and they don't provide a built-in way to do that, that kind of makes me want to hook the two together.
Mm-hmm.
Say, for example, if I want to automatically post any questions that I post on Stack Overflow to my Twitter account or through IM or on my blog or something like that, that's when I'll generally want an API so I can wire it up myself.
I see. So it's sort of like a Yahoo Pipes kind of thing where you're just taking the output and routing it another way.
Exactly. Or mixing or filtering, you know, so maybe I only want certain questions, you know, that I'm interested in ASP.NET MVC questions, but only when they're answered by certain users. You know, that'd be, you know, maybe you can filter that through the site, but generally no. But with an API, you might be able to do something like that, or Yahoo Pipes, just get an RSS feed for whatever and select out certain elements, say filter on this. We used to do that all the time with CodeBetter RSS feeds, filter out certain people that we didn't want to read about. And that was a pseudo API. They provided an RSS feed, and then we could do whatever we wanted to with it, kind of.
I think that brings up some good points. One is, if your website sucks, like Twitter has had like no functionality for such a long time, they've added a few sort of token things, then the API is like, okay, our website sucks, so you need to build a better one. I mean, to me, that's just sloppy. That's just careless building of the website. But I think there is a valid case there when you're a really super advanced user. We actually have answered certain people by saying, look, you know, you're an extremely avid user of Stack Overflow. We can't build for the 1%. It's really tough to build for the 1%. We're trying to build because, you know, 90% of the people that come to Stack Overflow or really any of the sites are anonymous users. You know, that's the experience we have to optimize for in a lot of ways. Now, to be clear, we totally value the 10% that are really avid users. But as you get more and more to the extremes of behavior, you look at sort of custom clients. And then there's also the example of we should build an iPhone app. We haven't had time to do that. The community is willing to build an iPhone app, so all we need to provide is the API. So it's crazy not to turn down the opportunity for people to contribute free work that makes them look good, makes you look good, you know, everybody wins kind of scenario. So I definitely absolutely wanted to have it. It was a must-have thing. I'm just sort of trying to explain like sort of why it took so long for us to get there. Because to me, if the website experience isn't good, then who cares if you have an API? You know, I mean, I guess Twitter would be the one exception. Twitter is the exception in like every conceivable way.
Right.
It's like, let's just totally suck and still win.
Well, yeah. I mean, with Twitter, there was enough valuable information. And then the API really was their safety valve that like, okay, the website's, you know, is pretty bad and it's down all the time. But because the API was good enough, then everyone wrote all these things where you could, you know, filter on hashtags or you could do all kinds of things, you know, and you know, I kind of see the continuum of going from something like that where it's just like, okay, the site's awful, but the API at least lets you get around that, all the way up to like Firefox, where, you know, you've got this extension model and other, you know, a lot of other good software following that now, but like, you know, really vibrant extension model. And then you can pull features in that you see are most popular. You blogged about this in the past too, but you know, where it's like, if an extension is great, then, you know, you can use that kind of as your farm team to see what features people really actually will use as opposed to just say they'll use.
Oh, totally. And I think it's again, sloppy ownership if you're not taking sort of the most popular things and just folding them into the core. I think that's just the most obvious design in the world. And then when you're not doing that, then you're just failing the community in a huge way. You're just not paying attention to what people are actually doing. Now, this has already worked for us. I mean, we've gotten some awesome. If you go to stackapps.com and click on the apps tab, there's Stack Printer, which is like really cool. Because we haven't, you know, optimizing for print is just a pain, right? I mean, first of all, who prints stuff, right? I mean, it's just not primary exciting use case for us. We have a print style sheet, but it's sort of minimal. But this app actually formats the entire post in a really friendly printer way. It totally fills a gap on our site. So now whenever people say, wow, your printing kind of sucks, I'm like, yes, it does suck. And there's this awesome add-in written by this really cool programmer that you should go check out, right? So he sort of gets the glory for doing this, and you know, everybody who needs to print can print. So I mean, I'm a huge fan of API, but I think there's also risk in sort of doing it wrong. And yeah, so it's a big topic. It's not something we took on lightly by any means, but I feel like we had one of the best people on it, and we've tried to involve the community in every step of the way. So, I mean, just go to stackapps.com and see what you think. We've gotten some compliments, so I think we're doing okay.
Yeah, I was going to ask like what the feedback has been generally. I mean, everyone loves JSON data. It looks like you've provided all the, I mean, from what I've looked at, it looks like you've provided all the main things people are going to want to get at. Do you have enough of the filtering kind of information where you can say, like, I would like everything within this tag or that matches this kind of, you know, like, can you query?
Yeah, I mean, it's ultra flexible. I mean, our philosophy has been anything you can get to from the public website that's not, you know, hidden secret data. And also some things we don't surface well on the website that are actually basically public just through quirks of the UI. We don't show it for whatever reason. So anything you see on the public website, you can get to programmatically through the API. And we've had enough community feedback that I don't think we're missing anything at this point.
So that, I've got a question which kind of leads on to another question, which is the kind of, as you had already launched this very cool API, which I agree is using all the standards everyone's going to expect to see, then Scott Hanselman and other people asked, you know, why aren't you using OData?
Oh, God, OData.
So there
so
you go.
So tired of talking about it. So we do support OData. So let me talk, because I saw there was a... also, we lost some people in the call, so while I'm talking, maybe you can try to get them back.
Oh, they've been re-added, sir.
Okay, cool. Yes. So make sure everybody's on here. There was a question about what statistical data do you store in case people want to do research work? So starting about, gosh, I guess almost a year ago, we started doing regular dumps of all our data because everything is Creative Commons. It belongs to the community, not to us. And so we dump it all out, and if you want to analyze it, you can do that. And it's done through what used to be called Legal Torrents, is now called ClearBits. By the way, much, much better name. sort of a really cool community torrent service that's for legit content. And we've had several people do research papers, several like real educational institutions take this data set and actually analyze it, which is awesome. I mean, A, it's publicity for us. B, it gives us information, like they're actually looking at questions we've asked ourselves. Like for a long time, the community had this idea that the person who answered first got like all the riches. Like whoever answered first got all these extra benefits. partly because of a side effect of the sword order that I don't want to get into right now, but for a variety of reasons, whoever answered first had undue, it was unfair, because they had all these, they had unfair advantage. And they actually analyzed the data and found that this, in fact, wasn't true. That the person who answered first did not actually, according to the data, have this unfair advantage that the community thought. So they're actually solving interesting problems.
Yeah.
Answering interesting questions that a lot of people have about the data.
And so I think you need a tool tip there is for the first person answering the question that said, "Did you know you will not get great riches?"
The whole situation is just bizarre because, I mean, in a Q&A system, it's just odd for people to complain that answers are coming too fast. You know, it's like, oh no, that's terrible, right? Your question's getting answered like instantly. That's terrible. What a terrible, terrible thing to happen to you.
But it's not the question asker that's complaining, right? It's the other answerers.
The other answerers. Yeah. Yeah. The economics of a Q&A system are really interesting because there's a lot of misconceptions. First of all, the people, and even people who design Q&A systems believe this, that the questions have value. But the reality is that there's an infinity of questions. The world is awash in questions. What the world is not awash in is like good answers. So really, when you're designing a Q&A system, you should be optimizing for the people who answer. So you're right. I mean, we do want to satisfy those people. So if they thought, hey, there's this issue, we should address it because they're the engine providing everything in the system. The people who ask questions think they're very, very important to a man. Like, and it's funny because the people who are really experienced users will rarely ask questions. It's really rare because they know, A, how hard it is, and they tend to research everything they do and blah, blah, blah. So the economics of a Q&A system are non-intuitive. And as many times as I've explained this to as many people who will listen, they just don't get it. They'll just say, you know what you should have on your homepage? A big ask question box. And they don't understand, like, that would actually destroy our system, like, literally. Like, if you made it really easy for, like, the average, you know, newbie coder who doesn't know anything just to type gibberish in and press enter, you're going to overwhelm the answerers because, A, it's not interesting, it's not fun, it's not useful, and it's sort of abusive to their time. You know, they're contributing time answering this, and they're really the source of all work in the system. So anyway, but you're right. You do want to optimize for the people answering. So, sorry, I kind of got off topic, but we have this other site going back to OData.
That's okay. I'll edit all that out. Don't worry
yes.
about that.
no, OData.
Just kidding. Okay, OData.
We do support OData. I do like it as a format. To me, it was a kind of a somewhat generic format, which is why I want to do like a custom API where we're making absolutely sure that everything is working the way it's supposed to, and we sort of hand tune it. I mean, our philosophy with Stack Overflow has been, let's build this really highly customized thing to solve this domain-specific problem of A, programming, and B, Q&A. You know, we're trying to, you know, see how well it extends beyond programming, but that's the name of the game. We're not going to take SharePoint and customize it. I mean, the concept is ridiculous, right? Or take Drupal or whatever, you know, pick your favorite crappy CMS system. I mean, that's just a bad solution to the problem. So with that mindset, when I looked at OData, I was like, okay, this is like the SharePoint of sharing data on the web. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. I don't mean that in a strictly negative way, but I do mean that it is one size fits all. And that's not really been my experience. The way to build a really first-class web experience is to do a one-size-fits-all type solution. Now, that said, we do offer it. If you go to odata.stackexchange.com, you'll find there's a web UI for actually querying the current data dump. So you can actually do live SQL queries. This is hosted on Windows Azure. There's like syntax highlighting. You can save queries. You can look at other popular queries. This is actually a tool for learning SQL too. We're trying to promote this as a way to embed SQL into Stack Overflow posts. If you're trying to explain like, you know, inner join to somebody, mm-hmm. you could actually give them a hyperlink which does an inner join on our data set.
So that's running against the latest data dump. So that's
yes.
valid as of up to 30 days or so.
Yes. We're due for one like literally today. I haven't quite gotten to it yet. I'll get to it Sunday. But yeah, it would be at most 30 days out of date at any given time.
Now, as an aside there, so it sounds like that's a manual process to do that then, right? To do the data dump?
We have a program that dumps it out, but we have to upload it to ClearBits and, you know, set up the torrent, and then it has to be pulled into the OData tool. It's not fully automated yet. That's something we're still working on, but it's semi-automated.
So back to the kind of the optimizing for question askers or answerers?
Answerers.
Yeah, answers. I posted a link there in the chat, and I didn't want to blindside you if you hadn't seen it. And the reason I think you haven't seen it is because usually when they have Stack Overflow.
Oh, I've seen that.
Yeah. Yeah. Usually you respond in the comments somewhere or talk about it, but I didn't see you respond there, so I thought maybe you hadn't seen it. But that it does kind of bring
I did actually respond, but I was logged into my crazy Google credentials, so I showed up, and it's literally testing test guy. So look for the comment by testing test guy. That's
there
actually
it is.
Me.
Okay,
anyway.
I see.
For our listeners, we'll have that in the show notes, and it's from robertwell.blogspot.com, and it's the post is called Stack Overflow Fatigue.
Yeah, it showed up on Reddit for a day or two, had comments and blah, 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 as things on Reddit do. But that was something that I had kind of experienced. So I'll go to Stack Overflow occasionally. Usually I get there through, you know, an organic Google search like I'm supposed to. Sometimes I'll go there and I'll think, well, let's see if there's anything to answer. And, you know, every question that has zero answers is either one that's going to get marked as a dupe pretty quick because I've found an answer.
Right.
Or it's one that already has answers that are right enough, maybe.
Or it just
to
sucks.
The point, yeah. Or it's not that good, and I post a comment like, you know, you really need to fix the question because, you know, you're just asking me to write your homework for you.
Right.
And so I was wondering, you know, you've got it optimized for answerers, but I'm wondering if you're gonna if this is something you're seeing, or you know, you did kind of talk about it in the comment there, but I didn't read it because I didn't know that was you.
Yeah, well, it has a crazy name, so I wouldn't expect you to. Yeah, no, the article, I mean, we look at all the criticism. We try to take all that stuff seriously and think, you know, how can we improve the experience? I'm all about, you know, it can always be made better, and there's always tweaks. I mean, I'm an inveterate tweaker. I mean, maybe actually too much. Like, I love tweaking stuff to make it better. I think that's actually how you build great products. They're just a collection of really small details that work really well together. So I'm very serious about getting all the details right. So I'm happy to read articles like this. But in this case, there was definitely a fundamental misconception, because you already said, I arrived at the site the way I'm supposed to through Google. So if you look at that article, one of the first things, well, the last thing he says is, I think what might happen to Stack Overflow is people would only get there through Google, which is going to ruin it. And I'm like, well, that was the goal. You know, so I think he sort of misunderstood what the goal was. And I think also, if you read a little bit of his post, he was looking for more discussion-y type topics. Like, he wanted to sort of, you know, our engine is not really designed to do discussion. You know, I mean, it happens because human beings will discuss things. You can't stop them from doing it. They're born, literally born to do that stuff, to communicate with each other and socialize. But we optimize for information sort of shamelessly, you know, to the extent that we make discussion kind of hard. And it's not a great engine for discussion. So that's kind of by design. Now, you could also argue that you could go to Area 51, and there is a proposal on Area 51 called Not Programming Related, which the description needs some work, but it's basically for all the subjective discussion-y stuff that doesn't really have an answer. Like, it's unanswerable. It's like, you can have an opinion. It's like, okay, I think this, but it's not really answerable in the traditional Q&A sense of the word. For those kind of programming topics, like a site that people who want to do this stuff could go to, you know, like basically the Hacker News of you know, detailed programming topics. So I think there was, in this particular case, there were some sort of misconceptions about what the engine is supposed to do and how it's supposed to work. Now, the one part that is true, and I kind of touched on this earlier, is if there's too many bad questions, you poison the system. And that's something I'm actually very worried about at the moment, because the engine is getting, Stack Overflow is getting hugely popular. I mean, it's like this crescendo of just rising waves of popularity begets popularity. And there are definitely risks. I mean, popularity has a lot of downsides. In fact, we had people, when we came out of private beta, there were people begging me to not come out of private beta. They were like, no. If you let the hoi polloi in, they're going to ruin everything. You know,
please stay like AOL.
Well, just please stay with this really nice community, really smart people. And it was a really smart guy. This was not some noob. This was a guy who, I'm not going to name his name, but he's a guy
Kevin
I respect.
Kevin Dente.
Yeah, it was Kevin Dente, who totally sucks. But no. It was a guy whose opinion I totally respect. And he was right, but
no,
he was wrong. In that,
sorry.
Yeah. That having the larger community actually made the site much better, but I think there's a point, it's like that classic curve, you know, where, oh, nobody goes there anymore, it's too crowded. You know? And I think we got to come up with new ways to limit question askers and ensure that they're actually asking, they're putting some thought into their questions and they're not flooding the system. I had to ban two IPs that were from foreign universities where just clearly students were just asking literally the worst imaginable questions, just totally, I mean, oh, it was bad.
Is it
and
time,
like dozens of them.
Here's what I think. You need a CAPTCHA that just implements FizzBuzz. And they get a text area, and they just have to solve FizzBuzz, and then they're in.
There is, I mean, we have big city problems on Stack Overflow that a lot of the smaller sites don't have. Like, we don't really have these problems on Serverflow and SuperUser because they're just fundamentally smaller communities. So if you have an influx of some bad questions, it's fine. But when you have an influx of just, you know, hundreds, it's a totally different scale, and you have to approach it in very different ways. I mean, you have to have civic systems. I mean, you're really building a city. So you have to have a system of government and systems of law and rule that can handle the influx of this kind of stuff. Otherwise, you start to have social problems, you know, where just society is in decline, literally. So we take that stuff very seriously.
This all reminds me of the whole eternal September thing that happened to Usenet. You know, is that essentially the same problem, replaying itself out on Stack Overflow?
I think to some degree. But, you know, I think what helps us is that we have a lot of people that care about the system, not just me, but, you know, users who spend a lot of time there. We have moderators that are actually elected through an election process. And, you know, the average user can flag things for moderator attention, which is 15 rep you can flag. Vote to close. We sort of have this tiered structure where if you spend a little bit of time on Stack Overflow, you get power to help drive the system. And I think as long as people see that that some of this moderation stuff has teeth, that we're actually trying and really succeeding in many ways. I mean, we're not failing at this point, I don't think. I have concerns, but I always have concerns about how we could do things better. The moderation tools really have teeth and they really work. I mean, I've gotten a number of email comments about that where, you know, that's what they see. And as long as they see there's a rule of law in the system, they're willing to sort of help and say, okay, well, if there's a policeman that's actually going to deal with this, then I'll be happy to, you know, phone this in. But if it's going to be another call that goes on hold forever and nobody does anything, then why do I even bother with this stuff? And who cares about the system anyway? It's totally crap.
You know, one thing that I thought was a little interesting about Robert Elwell's post was that he talked a little bit about the idea of specialists and that he thought that people should be, you know, JavaScript experts or Ruby gurus or that kind of thing. In other words, that reputation is good to a point in saying, yeah, I understand how Stack Overflow works. But then, you know, if I answer a Ruby question, my reputation means nothing compared to if I answer an ASP.NET question. And I know you have done some things with that in the past as far as creating badges for different areas based on, you know, if you're if you get over a threshold in a certain specialty. But I wonder
so
if
in other words, they just want to put the John Skeet cap on.
Well, you know, not necessarily.
That's what they're looking for.
They want to know.
They want to ban John Skeet.
No. So this wasn't about a cap. It was more about, like, are you an expert in this field? Like, so, you know.
Well, that's how do you get declared an expert by, you know, answering enough questions. And they do have badges and tags for,
yeah,
you know, different technologies. But
true.
Well, that was another misunderstanding in the article, was he wasn't discovering the tag system. It's funny that, well, the tag-based badges that are a relatively new addition. It's interesting that you brought that up because I actually introduced a change, gosh, I don't know, in the last month, where tag-based badges actually have a different visual style. Because I realized that the tag-based badges are way, way harder to get than the average tag, with the exception of like some of the really esoteric gold badges. And they really should have been highlighted as such. Plus, they demonstrate that you know about X. They have a sort of a different meaning. So they should have been called out. So what he's probably reacting to was the fact that when you go to a user profile, you're seeing all these undifferentiated list of just badge, 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 badge. And now, if you go to a user page on Stack Overflow, pick a page one user so they actually have some of these badges, you'll see that the tag-based badges really jump out now because they have a much different visual style to indicate there's something different about this badge. So again, there was a kernel of truth there. He wasn't discovering something. And I actually agree with that, and that's why I made that change.
Well, and you know, maybe even, you know, here's my feature request, but along the way of even bringing that further, of if I'm looking at a question about JavaScript and I see Scott Kuhn has answered a question there and he has got a badge in JavaScript expert or something, that, you know, maybe I see that highlighted there or something, you know, that's associated with a question tagged with something that he's an expert in. You know what I'm saying?
You could. I think there's a point of diminishing returns. There's that classic curve of, like, you know, wearing a lot of medals and badges. I mean, because if you look at every post, I mean, if Scott posts, you can see a summary of sort of his experience level on the site. Now, you don't know if he's a Java expert, to be clear, but you have an idea, okay, he's got 20,000 rep. He's a very experienced user. He's been on the site he's been around the block a few times, right? Then you can look at the badge list and see, well, does he have a lot of gold and silver badges? Then he's given a lot of sort of advanced information that other people have valued, or you could have a lot of rep and just mostly, you know, a smattering of silver and bronze. I mean, you're getting a lot of information out of what we present already. I don't want it to become overwhelming. And then I also feel like the information should stand on its own. Mm-hmm. Like, Scott could have a bad day and give somebody bad advice just because he's a Java expert. I mean, everybody has their bad days, right? And everybody has their blind spots and people, I don't know. It could be that I just don't like the poster, right? I think every bit of information should be somewhat standalone.
I guess, and like you're saying, the reputation system is self-correcting. So if Scott gives bad advice in areas outside of his expertise, he's going to get dinged for it and his reputation will suffer. So in general, people with high reputation know not to give bad answers in areas they don't understand.
The things we're optimizing for, I think, really are working. But I think you have to understand that we're kind of tricking people a little bit in what we're really optimizing for is not actually if you're a JavaScript ninja. I mean, that helps. I mean, if you're answering a JavaScript job, let's say you're answering a JavaScript question, what we're really optimizing for is how good of a communicator are you? And how can you format your post to be very, very clear and very, very understandable so that people like it, you know? And that is more, there's a number of things going on there, but it's really, are you a good communicator? I mean, this is something Joel's talked about and Steve Yegi has talked about and I've talked about, is what ends up winning in the real world is not so much knowledge, as much as we'd like that to be the case. It's like combination of knowledge and are you a good communicator? And I find that is what we're in fact optimizing for, is the people who can communicate best really tend to win in our system. And I don't really have a problem with that. But you do have to remember that it could be somebody who's a very good communicator, but maybe not has the best knowledge. But I find that people, like, if you ask a question, you're going to read almost every answer, unless you ask a BS question that's really not a question. You get, you know, 60 answers, in which case it's not a question, it's a discussion. If you really care about that problem, you're going to read every answer. I can't think of any question I've ever asked on Stack Overflow where I haven't read in detail every answer that came in within a space of, like, say, 3 days that I asked it.
Mm-hmm.
So people are going to pay attention. At least the question owner is going to pay attention, I think, to anything that you answer a question with, regardless of your reputation, because they have problems. I mean, there's some reason that they ask this. They really need an answer.
Right. You're motivated.
Yeah. At least they're motivated.
Yeah. So I was going to switch gears a bit, as long as anyone else doesn't have any problems with that. And if they did, they would have spoken by now. Right, Kevin?
Well, actually, I have a question that's sort of Area 51 related, but sort of not, which is, Jeff, what do you tell people that want to have a Q&A type community like you guys offer, but have no hope because of the community they're targeting or the size, you know, it's a regional thing, that they have no hope that they would ever be voted up high enough to be a Stack site? Do you have another answer to give those people?
Well, I think there's maybe a couple answers, but the first one is to bear in mind this is kind of a marathon, not a sprint. I mean, we plan to be around as long as we can, 5 years minimum. I mean, I mean, who knows what the world is going to look like in 5 years? I mean, to me, that's like, you know, flying car future type stuff. But we're in this for the long haul, and when you start a proposal, it's going to be around for years. I mean, I think over time you should be able to get enough support to cause something to happen, as long as it has enough critical mass. So that's number one. Be patient and try to build an audience and keep, you know, inviting people to your proposal, explaining what it's about and why you want to have that. And then number two, the network itself is going to grow. So as we add more and more sites, we're going to bring in more people. And those people will be funneled to Area 51 and say, hey, if you like this site, help us create other ones in areas of your interest. And some of those people, you know, again, we're playing 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon, may be interested in what you're interested in. They will find your proposal and they will then hopefully join in. So we're drawing these Venn diagrams of like these overlapping circles. And eventually these circles get bigger and bigger. And just a small fragment of that circle might be enough to get you through. Now, that said, are there niche topics that we may never be able to launch? Probably. My attitude is to go slower in the beginning. Joel has this idea that we're going to have quote-unquote thousands of sites. That scares the crap out of me. I think maybe eventually we might get there. I would be happy to launch 5 sites a year. Let me annotate that. Maybe 10 sites a year to be very, very aggressive. Because I would rather have a bunch of really high quality sites that I love and that I feel are loved by us and we can give attention to and help those communities grow, rather than have 1,000 sites where we can't. I mean, how can we possibly, I mean, even with the number of people that we have, I mean, how intimately involved could we be with each one of those sites? So I don't know. There's some balance there, but I mean, is there some pet topic that you had in mind?
Let me give you an example, and I think you'll be able to appreciate this, Jeff. You know about the Berkeley Parents Network, right?
Yes.
Do you use it?
Yes, Betsy uses it.
Yeah. So for people who don't know, Berkeley Parents Network is this local Bay Area sort of Berkeley, Oakland, San Francisco mailing list that's, you know, where people write in their questions about, you know, who's a good painter, who's a good nanny, and a variety of topics.
And it really works well. I mean, we use it.
It's a phenomenal resource. And at the same time, it is the most god-awful
software
system. I mean, it's literally like you send an email to somebody and like 2 weeks later, somebody, you know, like sends out an email summary of everybody else's questions. So you're waiting forever to get an answer. I mean, it's the perfect kind of thing for Stack Exchange, in my opinion. And yet it's so small and so regional that right. I don't know that it would ever, you know, get enough critical mass to be a Stack site. And yet it's like immensely valuable for that small community.
Well, I might be undermining myself a little bit, but to the extent that, you know, it's more about the community than us winning, I think what you might actually be looking at there is we want to be an example of how the software can be better. We want to be sort of viewed as, that was actually another one of our little corporate vision statement goals, was to be an example, like try to do all the right things, try to actually be in harmony with the community, and try to show sort of the internet community at large, like, hey, there's this actual Q&A thing that works better than this other crappy software that we're using. Inspire open source clones, because we're not really going to be open source. We've open sourced some parts of our system, but at our core, we're probably not going to be an open source system. But there will be clones of us. And I am totally okay with that, because that just broadens the reach of better software for everyone. You know, we can't solve all these tiny niche problems, but some open source clone of us could. So that may be what I would actually propose in that scenario, is that we're out there saying, okay, here's a design document, just clone us, right?
Which has already happened, actually.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you can't, that's my point. You can't actually stop it from happening. It's stupid to even fight it, right? It's like, well, no, don't clone us. All you can really do is keep evolving and stay one step ahead, which is, that's my actual plan. But that said, even an old version of us is better than the crappy Soviet era, not even Soviet era, that's like teletype area era software that you're talking about, like line printers printing out stuff.
Right. And like you're saying, that's so smart. Instead of trying to concentrate on, you know, don't copy where we were 2 days ago, like move forward. And you guys are moving so quickly that, you know, if anyone copies where you were two or, you know, a year and a half ago, that's great. That's a huge improvement over, you know, I mean, it solves the problem so much better.
I think, too, we also have a certain vision about like things we don't want to do and what we want to be. And I think the open source guys, I think, want to be all things to all people. And they end up kind of screwing themselves, in my opinion, because they can't be like Apple, where they're like, you know what, we're not going to ship with a floppy drive. Like, no open source thing would ever decide to drop the floppy drive in 1998, right? But I think that was the right decision. I mean, they've made a bunch of other decisions that I may or may not agree with. But my point is, we're making decisions about like what not to do. And trying to solve a very specific narrow niche of problem that I think helps us have focus and helps us drive forward in ways that sort of, you have this octopus effect with some of the open source stuff. It's like, oh, let's do this and this and this and this. And they end up not really doing anything really well, or diluting what they are, you know. So, I mean, I think there's other advantages, but generally your writer philosophy is to keep evolving and keep making it as you know, better.
So we are coming up towards the end of the time. We've got one interesting question we got from Twitter was from Strickland, username Strickland, and he said, how's that SQL Server scaling working out? And, you know, I wanted to ask that, but also just kind of the broader question of how's that Microsoft, you know, web platform working out, and how's that Microsoft hosting working out? Because, you know, in the broader ASP.NET Alpha Geek community, there are people saying, you know, I'm moving off of ASP.NET onto Rails and all that. And, you know, I mean, it's an interesting question there. And it's just kind of interesting. I think you guys are in BizSpark and, you know, just wondering how in general, like, things are working out for you.
The only sort of recurring nightmare I have is that the Stack Overflow database is quite large and getting larger all the time. Not at you know, an exponential rate or anything scary like that, but you can certainly envision a point where, you know, our strategy has been the classic big iron strategy. You know, we buy big servers with lots of memory because, I mean, really, hardware, again, is just so cheap now. I mean, it makes no sense to have a server with less than, say, 16 gigs of memory, I think would be the minimum that I would even consider for a server today. And what can you build and not scale to like a pretty high degree with 16 gigs of memory, where the database is effectively in memory all the time anyway? You could write some pretty crappy code and get away with it. So then if you're smart and you don't write crappy code, I don't know. I mean, I think you don't need to spend very much money to have an extremely scalable, classic, old school database backend. I mean, that's what we're basically proving and doing. Now, where will we be in 10 years, 5 years, 3 years? That's where it gets a little hazy for me. Will memory keep up? Will we have to shard the database? Will we have to start doing some, you know, very non-traditional database stuff? I don't know, because if you look at a lot of the really big web apps, that's sort of the classic problem. They're generating just astronomical amounts of data, and there's just no way traditional databases can really deal with it. And that I'm sympathetic to, because I can see it happening, even in our data set, which is, I think, much smaller. So I do worry about that. That would be my only worry, is sort of the classic database paradigm. Not so much the Microsoft platform stuff, but the classic database paradigm is what I'm worried about. Because I do see cracks in it. I see what they're talking about. And things just start to get really painful, and you have to be very, very clever to work around that. And I think a lot of these key value big table type stores make it sort of no-brainery. It's like, oh, I can have, you know, 10, 100 gigabyte database and not even think about it.
Well, so the main criticism of the MS platform thing isn't necessarily that it can't handle all the data. It's that you pay through the teeth to handle all that data compared to the Rails and other solutions. And you know, you mentioned you guys here on BizSpark and certain alpha geeks in the community who will not be named, Rob, have said that, you know, BizSpark is kind of like a ticking time bomb, where, you know, you've only got so many years to make sure that you can scale up to whatever you're at in 5 years or 7 years, whatever the BizSpark license is. Mm-hmm. And then you've got to be able to pay for, you know, you have to hire a PhD in economic theory to figure out the Microsoft licensing scheme that you need to scale to where you are.
Well, I think I got to go back to my earlier comments, which is I've kind of stopped believing in paying for software. And I'm sympathetic to what he's saying. Not necessarily because of the money, because I don't think the only thing that's really expensive there, hardware's not expensive. The server operating system licenses are actually not that expensive. The dev tools, none of that stuff is really expensive. What is really expensive is SQL Server. SQL Server is absurdly expensive. Like, if you have to ask, you can't afford it, expensive. So I think you really have to focus on that piece of the tool chain when you're having that conversation. Like, why is that so weird? And Microsoft has this other weird secret-ish, like, pay-by-the-month type licensing, which is actually much, much cheaper, like dramatically, order of magnitude cheaper. But it's complicated. I mean, even if I just having to figure all that stuff out just sucks, right? It's just friction. It's like, why go through the brain damage of even thinking about this stuff? And I think it's kind of like Microsoft has to demonstrate that they're bringing enough value that the mental time you're going to expend thinking about this is worth it. You know, am I actually getting a much better experience than the open source alternatives? And that's on Microsoft. You know, I think yes, for where we are, I can say that, you know, part of it's my inexperience. Like, if I started with Linux, I would be just so hosed, because I wouldn't know anything and I'm just such a noob when it comes to Linux, whereas I know Microsoft stuff like forward and backward. But given, let's say you had like equal experience in both, I would say the only real compelling thing I would look at today is I do think the Microsoft tech is faster. I think you can write crappy code that will run much, much faster on because of C# is a compiled language and very mature, and SQL Server is actually quite fast as long as you don't make any really dumb noob mistakes. That would be my argument currently, that you can be quite fast. But again, like, who needs speed? Like, when are you going to get to a point that it even matters? That might not even matter.
Well, my point would be that as far as the web front end, like the web head actually on these things, it's, you know, use whatever. Because your bottleneck is never, ever going to be your web page, no matter what you write it in. If you write it in COBOL, if you write it in MUMPS,
That's not entirely true in my experience, but I mean, it's close to true.
Yeah, but you're going to run into a database bottleneck far before, you know, way before you run into any kind of a, you know, oh, my web server's overloaded with hits.
Well, yeah, because, but I mean, caching comes into play too, right? I mean,
between caching, but and there's all sorts of trickery and proxies you could put on the front end to cache, you know, certain parts of your app and the way that you set things up, so that no one's going to notice if your web page is written crappily. I mean, yeah, there are some exceptions where, you know, you can write a really bad for loop or something in there that takes forever, or you're doing something. But even .NET isn't going to use more than I was just talking about this with Dustin a couple of weeks ago, Dustin Campbell, and I was arguing that, you know, throw as much RAM as you can on your servers, your web servers, and he was like, your .NET app is never going to use more than 4 gigs. That's the heap maximum or something, even on 64-bit CLR. And I've probably got that wrong, so maybe he can correct me later. But it was way below the 32-bit limit on addressable memory as far as the actual maximum size that the heap could get to. So, you know, having 16 or 12 gigs of RAM on your webhead didn't make sense unless you were also running other things on it that would use the RAM as well. But as far as, you know, where are you going to put your money and where the majority of your money is going to go and should go, it's going to be the database server. You want fast drives, you want a fast processor, you want multi-core, you want lots of RAM, because that thing's going to need to be a beast, because that's where the disk I/O is. That's always the slowest part of any application.
I think it comes down, a lot of it just comes down to personal choice. I mean, I think you should go with like what you know and what you like. If you decide at some point, you know what, I don't like the Microsoft stuff, like it makes me unhappy, then you shouldn't use it. But, you know, I've always loved .NET. I mean, I think it's a wonderfully designed language, and the framework and everything, every part of it is really, really good. IIS, I've been so on. I think 7 and 7.5 are dramatic steps forward to the point that I actually kind of like them now. IIS 6 and 5, I don't really want to talk about. And SQL Server, you know, I think just the performance, the licensing and the cost, I think is just a major bummer. But the tooling is quite good. The performance is excellent. I mean, I fundamentally like the tool chain. There's nothing in it that like makes me angry or, you know, I mean, could be that, you know, maybe I don't understand the alternatives well enough to really have a good opinion. But there's nothing here that would be pushing me away. And I think maybe that's what you got to look at as a programmer is, you know, and going back to comments I made early on, we're doing things because we love them and we enjoy them. So that's really what's driving these decisions. I mean, there's ways to build an amazing Rails app that performs brilliantly, you know, and you know, who cares? Servers are cheap, right? So it takes 5 servers instead of 1. Who cares? Doesn't matter in the big scheme of things. It comes down to what do you love and what do you enjoy, and that's what you should pick. So if at any point, I guess what this comes down to, if Microsoft isn't bringing joy to programmers, they're screwed. You know, if at some point, like, this is not fun anymore, this is not good, Visual Studio makes my life hell, they're done, right?
Yeah.
I don't think they're there yet. I think the developer division is actually one of the best divisions of Microsoft. I mean, I've always been very impressed. Like, IIS Express is, like, meeting a real need like we have on our project, like, right now. So they're actually doing the right things.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, you know, I mean, a lot of the arguments when I actually, like, talk to people, and sometimes it's, you know, I go offline with people and talk to them, and you know, they'll have these kind of semi-logical complaints, and when I keep talking, it's like, you know, I was just kind of bored. Like, I was...
Yeah, and that's fine. I mean, that's totally cool. And that's what Microsoft needs to fight. Developers shouldn't be bored. They should think it's cool. They should think the tools are awesome, right? And if Microsoft isn't doing that, that's their bad, man. I mean, they deserve to, you know, whatever fate befalls them, that's what's got to happen. But I got to reiterate my confidence. You know, I mean, I think Scott Guthrie is amazing. And I think the dev division at Microsoft is one of the strongest divisions they have. So, I mean, I think Visual Studio Express is brilliant. BizSpark is brilliant. I mean, I think they're doing all the right things to not fail. I can't really point to any way they're majorly failing, in my opinion. I don't know. Maybe you guys can.
Mobile.
Oh, mobile. Yeah. Well, I don't even count that. That's like, I don't even, that doesn't even rate. But yes, I would agree to the extent that I didn't even count it, because like that doesn't count.
Yes, I'm going to tweet that on my Microsoft Kin phone right now.
Right. Get to work.
You're one of the 5 people that bought that.
So we had a couple other questions, which I did think were kind of interesting over Twitter, from Michael Stumm, who's one of the top. He's been on Stack Overflow.
I think he was the first user to reach 10,000.
Yeah. Yes. So he asked, what does your testing and deployment story look like? Continuous integration, deployment, etc. So
cruise control. We use cruise control.
Cool.
And we have we have obviously local development tiers. We have a development tier of servers, and then we have the production tier. So between those three, the area that's kind of weak for us is unit testing. Now, there's a ton of unit testing in the API, where I believe that there's major value there, and because we have the surface of the API that we really, really don't want to break. So we have some very hardcore unit testing going on with the API, but I have not really been able to get the unit test religion. I do believe it in the abstract sense and in specific cases where I think it brings a lot of value, but that's probably the weakest part of our story, is we don't really have good unit testing, with the exception of the API, which is very, very good.
Do you have anybody on your team that's really like pushing for it, or are you all pretty much on the same page?
No, there's different opinions. I mean, mine is not the only opinion, and I don't really have the idea that, you know, my opinion has to be law. I mean, if I feel really strongly about something, I might fight you about it. But this is one of those topics where I recognize that there's a lot of room for improvement. It's just, to me, it's a lot of engineering effort sometimes to do the unit tests. And I would like rather, in a zero-sum game, it's like, do you want improvements in features and bug fixes? Or do you want... Now, I realize there's the argument there of like longer term, you would have less bugs. But I just can't say, in my experience working on Stack Overflow, there's many bugs. There's like a handful of bugs I can point to where if we had a unit test in place, this wouldn't have happened. It's quite rare. Like, I just find that the areas that are problematic are problematic because it's a bad design, you know? It's complicated, you know? And until you fix that, it doesn't really matter how many unit tests you put around it. The problem is that it's too friggin' complicated. You need to simplify it and, you know, make it simpler, basically. And that's how you fix, you know, I'd rather do that than build a whole ass load of unit tests around this super complicated thing that we've built. It's like, why is it breaking, you know? I mean, to me, it's like you got to get down further, lower in the root causes than that. I guess that's the basis. But I'm not against it. I'm very pro unit testing in the right scenarios.
I'll beat the TDD drum just a little bit here. Me and Kevin can that the TDD will help you get to that simplified design in the first place versus trying to fix it later. But, you know, it's all part of the design game that we play.
I worry, though, because I feel like it tends to encrust. It's like barnacles. It's like you build a shell around it, and then you're like, well, I could change this, but then I got to... It's friction. Like, now I got to fix these 10 tests because I changed the design. You know, it's not really broken. So then it's like friction. It becomes friction to redesigning the system, and that worries me as well. But all this said, I think every scenario is different. Like, for API, there's no question I want, like, hardcore, to-the-bone unit testing all the way down the pipeline. And for something like the .NET framework, oh my God, right? I mean, this is like a case study in where you would do that stuff. I think the more API, my personal opinion, this is just my opinion, the more API you get, the more frameworky you get, the more like this is a standalone component that I'm going to share you get, the more value there is in unit testing. The further afield you get from that, I think that's where it starts to, the value proposition starts to break apart for me a little bit. And I guess the other downside is programmers always like to think they're building a framework. There's nothing they love more than the idea that I am building a reusable component framework. And that's just so rarely the case, right?
I'm laughing because I've seen this so many times where people like goofed around for half of the project building a reusable framework. And then the project didn't, you know, there were some major problems with it. And if you look back in time and you say, what's the one thing we could have done to make this project launch on time and work right? It's like, don't make it just launch it and, you know,
just actually build the project.
Yes, yes. But it's like a developer Achilles heel where we just have to do it. We have to say, you know, if I'm managing content, why don't I build a content management system? Like, it just makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
The cycle that I like to optimize for is the cycle of, okay, there's a problem. How quickly can we fix the problem? I mean, that's really the cycle that I'm really interested in optimizing the crap out of is, you know, once we deploy something, how quickly can we find the problem? People can tell us there's a problem or, you know, we could notice it somehow and then get some kind of improvement or fix out there. And if, you know, unit testing ends up being the way to do that, then, you know, I'm all for it because to me, that's the cycle that matters.
Okay, so we had one last question that I was going to ask from Twitter, which was from Alex Angus, and his question was, how has your role changed with this, with all these people new How has your role changed with all these new people joining Stack Overflow? Are you still in the trenches?
There's definitely that classic Metcalfe's law of these connections, these communication lines between people. You know, when you have three people, you have, you know, a certain number of lines, and it's like, I think it's like number of people squared. So I think what my strategy has been is to create these little splinter cells of people that can operate somewhat independently. So you don't have, it's weird because you'll hear in business, and I think Joel is starting to feel the same way I do about this, is you always hear, okay, you know, everybody should be communicating all the time and, you know, everybody should be in the loop. And I found that actually you want people not to be communicating all the time, because that's when you, particularly when you have more and more people, if everybody's communicating all the time, that's all you do. And for me, you know, a big part of my day now is just syncing up with people and seeing what's going on and talking to them. And it's a huge chunk of the day. And I think what helps us is that we tend to hire on my team remotely. So we have a developer in Germany, in London, and now we just hired somebody in Australia. And then, gosh, the list is long. DC, Florida, North Carolina, Oregon, Texas. So actually having the people be remote is actually kind of an advantage, because they understand that being remote, they have to kind of optimize these little communication windows they have with you, and be able to operate independently. I mean, when you hire remotely, you're not going to hire the intern that's going to need to learn how to use, you know, C# delegates. Right. You're only going to hire people that are fairly experienced, that can sort of leaders sort of on their own and good at communication. I would say the biggest risk for what we do is sort of the quiet guy problem. I mean, we can't hire the quiet guy, although the quiet guy can be a great programmer. In a remote scenario, it's just it's completely unworkable. You need the guy who's going to like kind of bitch a little bit. About things and like, I don't really think this is the right way to do this. And he's going to kind of speak up and sort of interject and in a way that makes sense, right? Where you're interfacing at these regular times every week or every day and it'll bring up problems. Whereas the quiet guy is just going to like, it's kind of a problem, but I don't want to bug anybody, you know? So he's making the most of these limited communication windows that you have to have. So that's what saves me. That's why I'm able to have, you know, gosh, 10 or however many people it is now. On my team is we break up into these little groups that have some projects that we're working on, and they have more or less total control over those projects. But it's definitely challenging because I really do like to write code, and I like to, you know, check in and see what's going on. But the more people you have, you start to need somebody whose job it is to just coordinate everything that's going on. And, you know, before you know it, all of a sudden you wake up and you're the pointy haired boss. You're the manager guy. You're not actually doing any coding anymore. You know, it's kind of scary. And you're just the guy, you know, like, in worst case, you're like an office space. I bring the messages to the engineers.
Right.
You know, and they do the work from the customer.
I have to point out that your coding horror avatar has pretty pointy hair.
That's true.
So,
That's true.
Issue.
But yeah, the whole communication thing has to be managed very, very carefully. Otherwise, it just tends to overwhelm.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's definitely a problem in any company, but especially in, like you're saying, a remote work situation where you've got that whole kind of like the N squared thing, and you've got to check on people who aren't saying anything and all that kind of stuff.
We're still figuring it out. I mean, I wrote sort of a blog entry about our current uncoding horror, about my current thinking about how it's supposed to work. And that's working reasonably well. And we talked to Miguel de Acasa, who gave us some really nice tips. He has a huge distributed team that does amazing work, obviously. And he had some really nice tips about how to get it to work. But, you know, in working with people, it's also personalities. It's like, do I like this person? Do I care about what I'm working on? But I think there's really so much joy in working on Stack Overflow. We feel like we're building something that matters. And I think a lot of times our little failings on how we're doing things are sort of trumped by the fact that we really believe in this thing that we're doing, that it matters, and that it's going to be useful to people. And, you know, we're doing it in harmony with the community. We're not just, you know, fighting the community. We're saying, hey, let's build this cool thing together as a group.
Are Miguel's comments, are those just private email things, or are those in a public post or something?
Well, I summarized the best I could in the post.
Oh, cool.
Miguel has kind of gone quiet lately. I haven't really seen him on Twitter. I don't actually know what's going on with him. I think he maybe had a baby. That tends to do that to you. Wasn't he having a baby? He was buying a stroller and stuff.
I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't think he's had it yet. But
he's been really quiet. I don't think I've even seen him on Twitter, unless I unfollowed him accidentally or something.
It happens. Twitter will do that
Twitter,
for you.
Hey, randomly unfollowed people. Yeah, that's great. That may be what happened. Maybe he's fine.
Yeah,
I asked him for feedback, but he's a really busy guy, so I didn't hear back. But as far as I understand, I summarized it somewhat accurately. So if you want to know his opinions, you can read that blog post. There's obviously a lot more to it than that, but I think those are really good guidelines if you want to do remote development.
Yeah, as pretty much anything in my software career, I've had, you know, notes about things I wanted to write about remote teams and stuff, and then you wrote a post that pretty much crushed it. So, but yeah, I mean, yeah, it's there are definitely some things that you just have to do right in order to get a group of people all remotely to work together. So that's cool.
But it's exciting. I mean, getting back to sort of the vision of, you know, it's exciting because when you're on Stack Overflow, you're working with another programmer who may be in Brazil for all you know, right? And yet you're collaboratively working on this little tiny thing. And to me, it was exciting to think that, hey, let's actually try to make the development of Stack Overflow kind of resemble the process on Stack Overflow, you know, break it down into small pieces. And do it in a way that's public and shared. And we're doing it with people all over the world. And that's why I was very adamant that when we expanded the team, we had to bring in these international users. I mean, they were just a huge part of what made the site successful. So it seemed sort of not genuine and not authentic to make this sort of some sort of US-centric thing, when in reality, it's I mean, you know, more than 60% of our traffic is outside the US.
And as a side note, it was cool when I was in Munich to meet Ben Dunkel, who is, you know, was a new hire to the team. Berman. That was cool.
Ben is amazing. Ben did the unicorn thing that we did for April Fool's Day. He's just bored. He just built. You know, I like to joke that Stack Overflow is powered by bored programmers because it really is true, actually. And Ben is a good example of that because he built these amazing things. I'm like, wow. You know, he's building this unicorn thing. He built this game based on Stack Overflow using the actual data dumps. And they were very, very impressive. I mean, so I was ecstatic to be able to, he was available and, you know, we were able to reach out and he wanted to be on the team. I mean, that was, to me, that's what it's all about. It's just finding the people that love the same things you do. Just like on Stack Overflow, I love programming and I love hanging out with people who love programming. So being able to build a team where we all love the same things and just having it just, you know, synthesize and happen automatically is amazing. And I love it. It's the best job I've ever had.
You know, if I remember right, he was on the team when I was in Munich for web camps, and we do these on the second day, we build projects. And I'm pretty sure he was on the winning team there too, where it was a game. And he said, okay, everyone's got all these boring ideas. How about we play Battleship? I propose we do a jQuery, you know, Battleship game using MVC. And his team won the contest because it was the most fun app. So that's pretty neat.
Right. Well, exactly. Fun. I mean, that's what it's all about. And the joy of what you're doing. I love Phil's blog post. I mean, Phil is crazy about football, soccer, but I loved his post about, you know, joy. You know, that's what makes a team good, is they have joy in the thing that they're doing. And I think Ben's a good example of that, and all the things that he's doing. So
cool. All right. Well, we're at the end of the show now. Normally at this point, we ask you to pimp stuff, but I think you've been doing that the whole time.
Oh, God. Yeah, I got to stop, right?
So any last words? Can we wake up K. Scott?
He's dead.
Hey, I'm still awake. I'm still awake.
Okay.
Just barely, though.
Hey, yeah. I had interjected on IM that I had one more question, but
hit it.
Okay. So, you know, you talked about how unit testing is not your thing, and I don't want to go on at some pro unit testing
screen. Oh, yes, here. You do.
Well, I've done it before. I don't need to do it again. but I am curious what you're testing, you know, how you guys do test. I mean,
well, the way it happens on my team is that I don't do it, and other people that are more talented than I do it. I think we cheat a lot. This actually came up, and it was a really interesting question recently, some public event I did. And we cheat because we have a community that loves our thing so much. And it's like, I mean, they notice everything we do. Let me give you a little example. Like tonight, I changed the footer. I literally changed the footer. I changed one link to another link. Within 1 hour of deploying that, there was a question on Meta. Why did this footer link change? Does this mean X? You know, like people are paying so much attention to what we're doing that they are human unit tests. Anything we do that is wrong, that isn't, like, I guess nobody cares, gets flagged and talked about like almost immediately. So I'm cheating like hell, because if we deploy something that's bad, our community is going to let us know, like, I mean, literally within 10 to 15 minutes. Now, on a traditional app, like say you have some corporate app that only 10 people use, I mean, do they even care? They don't want to use your app. Are they going to pay attention to every stupid thing? And there's some catastrophic data error that they wouldn't notice for like a week. So, I mean, we cheat, I guess, is the short version of what I'm saying.
But even beyond just, you know, little things like that, I mean, you guys run a very high-scale site. You know, have you had issues where you deploy a fix that, like, craters the performance of the site? And
The thing that's odd is we have a very loose development style. It's not... I mean, it's disciplined to the extent that we're all very, very experienced. And if anybody feels something's really wrong and bad, they're going to speak up about it. And they would professionally wouldn't want to be associated with. So it's not like we're deploying crap, but we make tons of mistakes. And I think as you get through the process, you optimize for this mistake fixing process. So you become so good at rapidly fixing the mistakes. And that's the process that you optimize for, that from the outside perspective, it looks like you're not making mistakes, but you're just really fixing them very rapidly. So I would say we make tons and tons of mistakes, and I deploy bad things all the time. but not bad in big dramatic ways. No, I wouldn't say that. That is uncommon, because we do, you know, we test locally, we test on dev. And I think we get nervous. We do, like, if we're doing something we get nervous about, like, wow, I'm changing this core login sequence. We'll do a code review with one of our team members to make sure we didn't do anything crazy. And usually that's good enough. And we get all the sort of low hanging fruit of like, wow, that would have ruined our site. yeah, and it could be too, Kevin, that the engine's just kind of mature now, so we're doing a lot more like tweaking than like radical rewriting of stuff. I don't have a good answer. I mean, I guess my short answer, web development is just kind of loose. I mean, it doesn't take extreme discipline to produce something. I mean, again, I have to go back to Twitter. Twitter, I mean, how more incompetent could Twitter be, and yet they're successful? I mean, they set the bar so low that, like, I'm actually encouraged. It's like, look how much you can suck and still succeed.
Well, we don't all have Oprah using our apps. We don't all have Oprah using our apps.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, once you get to that point, you can do that. But you don't have that luxury when you're small. So, like I said, we're kind of cheating in that regard. That's true. Sorry. I know that wasn't a particularly exciting answer. I'm sorry.
No, that's awesome.
Kevin damns you with his silence.
Yes.
I know. He's like, well, that was unsatisfactory.
He's judging you.
It's what he does. He does. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Is that a good way to end the podcast?
I think so, with Kevin's disapproval.
I think so, yeah. That'll give us hate mail. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So on that note, let's wrap it up. Goodbye.
Yeah, thanks. I enjoyed it.
Awesome. And now
we can say he's been on twice.
Yes.
Now he's a friend of the show.
Gosh, I thought he'd been on before. Maybe it's, you know, I listen to every single Stack Overflow podcast, so I guess it seems like I hear.
Are they running together, John?
I guess so. That's all. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you just need to not look at the Jeff Atwood shrine while you're doing the podcast.
Well, I'd have to take it off the desk, and I wouldn't mind taking it off the desk, but it's so damn heavy, and it's made out of pewter.
Pewter and real Jeff Atwood hair.
He's not supposed to know about that. Awesome. Well, yeah. Cool.